This is the last intervention, and we hope to finish around 7, a little bit after 7 tonight. Armand Kless is the director of the Institute of, for European and International Studies in Luxembourg.
Thank you, François. This might not be the best hour of the day to talk. I'm aware of this. But if so many people leave now, that might not be because it's late, but that might be because of me. Because they have already seen what I'm going to say, since I'm supposed more or less to repeat here what I have written. That's the rules of the game, it seems. I would like to thank the organizers, especially, of course, my very good friend, François, for having put so much work in this, and particularly Lieven de Kouter, who has worked extremely hard throughout the months to make this possible, and his, of course, his whole staff and his whole team. I was also glad to see here, or to meet here again, so many friends with whom I had been in Iraq exactly 2 years ago. Unfortunately, despite our ambitions, we have, for example, Dirk Adriansen, who had worked very hard to make that visit to Iraq 2 years ago possible, thank you. And we were unfortunately not able to prevent the war, despite our wild ambitions. I have to warn you also, I'm not in very good shape. I may faint or break down during my speech, and perhaps won't continue. And you can also answer the questions. No, I haven't eaten anything the last 48 hours, despite some silly green pills called Imodium. So I'm a bit frail. I have not my usual vigor and aggressiveness. Anyway, I feel a bit embarrassed to talk to such a friendly, basically friendly in terms of ideas audience. I prefer a hostile audience. I feel a bit inhibited by this. I have no certainties to offer some questions, some provocations perhaps. And I will give no data or figures, contrary to some others, because we have seen before in the previous session that that may lead to some confusion or confused debate in the end. So, what about the neoconservative? Sorry for coming back to this, the neoconservative movement. John Eikenberry, whose work you may know, a rather conservative analyst, has spoken recently about the end of the neoconservative moment. So is this really conceivable at the very time when so many people see the neoconservatives firmly entrenched in power? That in fact the latter are losing steam and some or most of their luster. Are they really on the defensive? A species beleaguered inside and outside of the Bush administration? Or is their possible retreat just a provisional, tactical one? I think that the further fate of the neocons will depend on many imponderables, such as the evolution, above all, of the Iraqi situation or some terrorist, between quotation marks, terrorist events around the globe, and of course, particularly in the and what are the, in fact, the neoconservatives exactly standing for? And what is the difference between neoconservatives and traditional conservatives? It seems, and I have not examined very carefully their work, that the distinction between two is sometimes rather blurred. That's also why some analysts prefer to cite names rather than come up with clear-cut definitions. Some of these names, the main protagonists of neoconservatives, such as Richard Perle, of course, Charles Krauthammer, Robert Kagan, David Frum, Max Boot, William Kristol, and in a different category, Paul Wolfowitz. And then there are, of course, the traditional conservatives. Who are often associated with the name of Morgenthau, whereas the neoconservatives perhaps associated with the name of Strauss. Positions, I think, on key matters of international affairs between the two are often vacillating. And that's why it might be wiser to use terms that in a sense are more neutral, more vague, perhaps also less biased, such as right or rightist, fundamentalist or new fundamentalist, hawks, whatever. Certainly true that conservatives as well as neoconservatives share certain key values and that they are both convinced of the inherent superiority of the American model and the special mission of the American nation. They all tend to focus on the use of military power rather than of diplomacy. They prefer unilateralist, all this has been said today, unilateralist approach and coercion to persuasion, intervention to dissuasion, preemption to negotiation. I consider neoconservatives a kind of political and ideological nouveau riche, exhibiting more proudly, more aggressively their basic convictions. They are kind of zealots, showing greater contempt for international norms and rules, as well as for their allies, particularly, of course, the Europeans. Traditional conservatives accept alliances at least under certain conditions. They also tend to be more aware of the limits of power, and in general are more careful and restrained in the handling of that power. In any case, the neocons constitute the spearhead of a much wider movement, the crystallization of wider currents of the American society, the focal point of perennial aspirations, and the ideological hypostasis of much broader societal strivings. The neoconservative precepts constitute the paroxysmal expression of political desires increasingly present in the policies of the United States since the late 1940s in Republican as well as Democratic administrations. The basic approach of the neocons, it seems to me, is a Machiavellian one. All means that fit their ends are acceptable, including, in extreme case, extreme scenario, the use of nuclear weapons. And Latin saying came to my mind to describe this, "Oderint dum metuant." May the others, the rest of the world, even hate us, provided they fear us, they are afraid of us. That seems to me a basic, even philosophical tenet of the neoconservative beliefs. Neocons do not care very much about the psychological and long-term political implications of their actions. They prefer to create, and they say it. You have only to read the quite simple and simplistic book of Robert Kagan, Power and Paradise. A climate of fear rather than of trust. So I'm not misinterpreting anything. I think, I hope, they are prepared to bully foes and friends alike. They are guided by a general attitude of suspicion towards the outside world. There are no permanent friends, only permanent interests. Alliances and other engagements are just meant to suit American needs and can be modified at will. the aim of any active involvement in world affairs is to adapt those affairs to the American gusto. Any opposition, actual or potential, is to be eliminated. Neocons are guided by a mantle friend-foe scheme, a deeply Manichaean view of the world. Who is not with us is against us. They disregard humanitarian concerns and they are seldom moved by human misery and suffering. Neocons are bent on creating a highly stratified power system at a planetary scale with the US at its helm, a kind of global and total American empire where nobody would be tempted anymore to challenge US primacy. They want to establish a super capitalist world order under American guidance in which the last remnants of alternative economic and social systems are to be eliminated. Theirs is a totalistic and totalitarian design. The ultimate ambition is total control, absolute security and invulnerability, implying complete vulnerability for all the others. For those who will disagree with the United States, for the dissidents, the opponents, that means the terrorists, a kind of gigantic Guantanamo Bay camp might be envisaged. A camp for the psychological, what is Guantanamo Bay about? The psychological annihilation of any foes, a concentration camp where through sensorial deprivation the will of the inmates is broken and their self-esteem destroyed. The ultimate obsession at this point, when I'm in a different environment, five or six Americans tend to walk out. Last year in Brussels, for example, at Bibliothèque Salvé, two US senators and a former CIA director whose name also starts with a W walked out. And the representative of the Republicans in Europe took the floor after me and said, "I'm not a representative of a fascist government." So, but this is a different audience. The ultimate obsession of some more extremist neocons is a world under full US control where nobody would be able to move anymore without the United States checking those moves, where a kind of virtual protective fence would be erected between the US and the rest of the world. Technology, they hope, especially when it comes to achievements in space, will help them to fulfill those dreams. For the neocons, the war against Iraq was an excellent opportunity to demonstrate to the world the total superiority of the US in terms of raw military power, its will to use this power to reach its aims, to cow the world into subservience, and to prevent thereby the emergence of any rival ambition, to demonstrate the enormous and growing discrepancy of power between the United States and the rest of the world. The message to China, to Russia, and also to Europe was clear. Don't even try to think about being able to challenge our primacy. Not now, and not in 50 years. Of course there were other goals for that war against Iraq, and it was stated here, to establish a power basis in a geopolitically crucial area, preserve global American economic interests, contain Arab nationalism, spread American societal and civilizational norms, and so on. Iraq is another test case of what the United States is up to in its willingness to intervene wherever it wants, how it wants, with total impunity, to eliminate any opposition and make the world free for US global empire. From this imperial perspective, Islam is perceived as the single greatest obstacle to the Americanization of the world. The war in Iraq reflects basic traits of the American society, the hubris and greed of a megalomaniac ruling elite, which is a kind of plutocracy manipulating a profoundly pathological society. It has been launched and conducted in the usual American style, characterized by self-complacency, autism, racism, brutality, and cowardice. U.S. behavior in Iraq, particularly after the end of the formal military operations, instead of brutalize, in a sense, dehumanize young men, a kind of semi-automatic killers, as described by Anthony Swofford in Jarhead. The enemy is robbed of any human characteristics. Enemies are terrorists bent upon taking the life of innocent American citizens and can therefore be eliminated at will, pulverized for the greater well-being of the sacred nation. The American occupiers apply the same kind of savage behavior towards Iraqi prisoners. I was not here because I was not feeling well, to say the least, all day. I don't know if there was some talk about, for example, what happened in Fallujah, which is highlighting in a way what the Americans are up to and what they are achieving in Iraq. Just for those who may not remember the details, some up very briefly, for US so-called contractors having been killed, the United States vowed revenge immediately. In the wake of that, 400 or 500 or 600 people were killed. So for each U.S. contractor killed, about 100 Iraqi civilians, children, women, in random strikes against civilian areas, buildings. So this reminds certainly some of us of a certain kind of German behavior in Eastern Europe and even in Western Europe in the years 1939 or 40 to 45. One could also draw analogies between the, and again, I don't know if it has been done, and I don't want to go into detail, if we could have talked just on this, but this kind of topic has been suggested to me, between US behavior in Iraq, Israeli behavior in Palestine, Palestinian territories, and Russian actions in Chechnya. There are striking analogies and frightening ones. But again, that would lead us too far, perhaps. But my topic was Europe's reaction, so I haven't talked about Europe yet. There's some time left. Europe, of course, has nothing meaningful to oppose to the US design. Not an enlightened, liberal, progressive agenda, and not a conservative one. Europe is a shattered land, without any self-confidence, without a substantive political project for this or any century. Those European countries tasted till quite recently a kind of national grandezza, as for example Great Britain or France, exhibit the most pathetic behavior in terms of pretentiousness, hollowness, and cowardice, of course beyond the Iraq War. Europe is unable to devise any significant response to the American challenge. It appears helpless in face of the frontal American strategic assault. It reacts with embarrassment, yielding to American threats and blackmail, moving back before the gathering thunderstorm, buckling in front of the manifestations of overwhelming US power. Europe appears exhausted. It is helpless, dispirited, and confused, aware of its impotency and of its historic failure. An amorphous entity dominated by feelings of shame and even of guilt. This is exactly how the neocons, by the way, perceive Europe, as a trembling, stuttering, stumbling old man, unable to control its vital functions, eager only to rest, lost in lethargy, an assisted part of the world, not capable to exist by itself and to defend its existential interests, politically and ideologically divided, without a strong will, harmless and gutless, worn out by centuries of civil strife. The European Union is seen as an anemic, soulless, bureaucratic device without any sense of purpose. Indeed, Europe was unable to come up with any strong united political position on Iraq. The various attitudes, such as, for example, the Franco-German stance, were not based on fundamental philosophical, moral, or legal judgment, but rather on political contingencies, intra-European haggling, general misunderstandings, diplomatic opportunism, and American blunders. It was above all the product of circumstances, random events, of diplomatic escalation and polarization, a face-saving and hurt vanity. Therefore, this Franco-German stance is highly artificial, precarious, and ephemeral. It reflects the general situation of Europe, its frailty, its uncertainties, its hesitations, and its vacillations. Europe seems to be stuck forever in its idle, petty power games, its bureaucratic infighting, its endless quest for an elusive political order. It was partially safe during the Iraq crisis, at least those countries that joined the Franco-German camp, by the diplomatic clumsiness and miscalculation of the Bush people. They thought, the Bush people, that through a game of deception and promises, through the smart application of a mixture of political pressure and even blackmail and material incentives, they could induce Europe and, of course, the rest of the world to give in to American demands and thus get the support of the whole international community for the war as an extra bonus and facilitate at the same time the political task of their European allies, such as Blair, the late Aznar, and Berlusconi, responding to some of the anxieties of their public. The Americans, of course, got the spontaneous support, of course, because I expected it, of most Eastern European countries for their war plans. The leaders in those countries invoked their, one can also say, defended their shameless capitulation by invoking their experience under the communist regimes, the way they were treated by the Soviet Union, and their striving for freedom. It seems, however, that they were rather haunted by this perspective of freedom, the East Europeans, that they are longing, in fact, for a firm hand, a nation of Soviet-style colonialism with stars and stripes imperialism, and in general politically and morally corrupt leadership got the support In a process of betrayal and self-betrayal, a prominent so-called intellectuals, such as Václav Havel, Adam Michnik, or Georgi Konrad, proclaiming in concert with their reactionary Western European counterparts, such as Hans Magnus Enzensberger, André Glucksmann, or Bernard-Henri Lévy, and of course one can add somebody, some British intellectuals, also somebody like Timothy Garton-Ash, who has changed recently a bit, as some others did. This is the sign of their intelligence, I mean their flexibility, intellectual flexibility. Some people in Europe, politicians as well as analysts, had even expressed the naive or rather silly and perhaps also hypocritical hope that Europe would come out strengthened of this campaign, the Iraq campaign. The neocons and other conservatives were not surprised by the reaction of European governments, such as the French and German ones, and European public opinion in general, nor were they disappointed. As I had, I hope, made clear already before, the European reaction corresponded to what they had expected on the basis of their elementary analysis of European motives and aspirations, and they were even elated because the European behavior allowed them to draw a clearer line between themselves and the Europeans. By the way, they have, as they made clear from time to time, not just Rumsfeld, this is also true for most of the others, no deep respect for Blair's Britain, or Britain's Blair, Aznar's Spain, Berlusconi's Italy, not to mention Kwasniewski's Poland or Iliescu's Romania. Sorry, but I know what I'm talking about in this case. Of course, one could notice the dissociation between their rhetoric and their real goals when they were calling for a strong Europe, while in fact, Europe can't be weak enough for them. One has to admit that no matter how intellectually primitive the credo of the neocons is, no matter how crude their recipes, this creed at least reflects a will and gives them a direction, offers certainties, and tells them how to preserve power and how to impose their rule upon the world. It is probably true that there exists a historical disjunction between Europe and the United States, that the two are in different phases of historic development. It is almost trivial to state that Europe appears as a tired semi-continent spiritually, morally, politically, a terminal, an end society, end Gesellschaft, I would call it. After the totalitarian lapses in the first half of the 20th century, Europe seems too weak to engage in new totalitarian ventures. But there are creeping dangers nevertheless. The rampant xenophobia, the lack of self-confidence, which in the European history has often set off reactionary policies and regimes, the unfinished revolutions, or rather the pseudo-revolutions in Central and Eastern Europe, the looming crisis of the welfare state, the general intellectual and moral disarray, the political softening, the growing strategic irrelevance. The European Union itself is shrinking, diminishing in significance while expanding, and thus further eroding the scarce institutional achievements, losing its nerve and its last sources of inspiration. In this respect, some of the critiques of the neoconservative analysis may be deemed appropriate. But not, as the neocons assert, because Europe is unable to seek itself upon the world by violent means, not because it has no imperial ambitions, but because it is unable to muster a civil societal counter project and thus constitute a non-militaristic countervailing power to the American imperial model.
Thank you very much, Armand.